Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-5324, David Patchak, appellant versus Kenneth Lee Salazar in his official capacity as Secretary of the United States Department of the Interior et al. Mr. Birch for appellant, Mr. Avila for appellee, for federal appellees, Mr. Dumont for appellee, Potawatomi Indians.
Mr. Birch, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. This case involves the Secretary's attempt to take land in trust for the Gun Lake Tribe so that the tribe may build a casino that will bring more than 3 million visitors annually to a rural town of only 3,000 residents. Because the Gun Lake Tribe was not, quote, under federal jurisdiction in 1934 when Congress enacted the Indian Reorganization Act, this court should declare the Secretary's actions void. And I would like to address the issues this morning in the following order. First, standing, then the Quiet Title Act, and finally the merits issue under Carcieri. With respect to standing, the question is whether Mr. Patchak falls within the zone of interests, and he does. The case law makes it abundantly clear that a court should not inquire whether Congress intended a plaintiff to be a beneficiary of a legislative act. Rather, the question is whether there's someone that can be expected to police the act. In other words, an interest that the statute arguably protects.
One formulation is that that you need to be someone who's regulated by the act or your actions, or you're protected by the act. Now, you're abandoning that formulation for prudential standing?
Well, yes. The United States Supreme Court in several cases, and one I would mention is the National Credit Union Administration, has made it abundantly clear that a non-regulated party, even one in competition with the beneficiaries of the statute, can still be within the zone of interests if they're a natural person to police or protect the interest that the statute seeks to vindicate. And the interest here is one that the Secretary ignores when he talks about all the ways that the IRA benefits tribes. The interest is to limit the tribes eligible for trust acquisition to those under federal jurisdiction in 1934. That's the teaching of the Supreme Court's decision in Carcieri, that there is a limit in this statute, and that limit was intentional. If you read the majority opinion that Justice Thomas wrote, he walks through the legislative history and specifically about how the word now under federal jurisdiction came to be in the statute and says, this was a specific act that Congress made to limit the tribes eligible. So how does Mr. Patchak advance that interest? Well, the interest he seeks to vindicate here is preventing an incompatible land use in his community. And certainly it's an arguable...
Wouldn't you have a stronger case if you didn't have the IGRA? I mean, that's really the statute that was intended to bring the adjacent landholders into the equation and let them say, you know, don't build the casino here, we're going to have an influx of millions of people.
Right, and certainly there's no question that under IGRA there is that kind of interest. But the Secretary's regulations in the IRS context makes it clear that the same interest is present here. If you look at 25 CFR 151.10, subsection C and F, it says that in making a land and trust decision, the Secretary will consider a number of criteria to protect the statutory interests. Those include the purpose for which the land will be used, and most importantly, the potential conflicts of land use that may arise. And that is precisely
your opponents say that the intended beneficiary of that language are the state and the municipalities. What's your response to that?
Again, under the U.S. Supreme Court's precedent in National Credit Union and others, the intended beneficiary is not the correct analysis. The question is, who is the person who is in a position to police that interest? And certainly a member of the community who is interested in a conflicting land use is in a position to police that. And that's made abundantly clear here, where the state has already sided with the tribe.
Is your client's concern that the land will be that the land will be used by some group other than an Indian tribe recognized under 1934. Is that his concern?
No, his concern
is with that there's going to be a casino, right?
Correct, and bring the 3 million people.
And that's what IGRA is for.
Correct,
that's what IGRA is for.
Well, IGRA, but IRA as well.
And an objection to a casino, Congress has already decided that, and the state has already decided that, right? You get casinos if you follow the rules.
Well, not necessarily.
Under IGRA, you're not going to be able to challenge that it's a casino. You're going to have to challenge it that it violates NEPA or something
right,
like that.
Right. Let me back up. And, you know, this has already been challenged under NEPA. That was a separate lawsuit.
Right.
But back up. Under IGRA, one of the prerequisites.
What I'm suggesting is that the gravamen of your client's complaint that there shouldn't be a casino there is not one that we can address. That's not a concern of the statute. The statutes have already decided there can be a casino there provided certain boxes are checked, and those were all checked in the MISHCO.
Well, they were, but that still begs the fundamental question presented here. Under IGRA, you have to have land in trust for the land to be eligible for casino gaming in the first instance. And so the government went through the process under IRA to take the land in trust, and so they checked the box under IGRA. But now Who purchased the land? The tribe purchased the land.
With funding from where?
I don't know that. Presumably from the Las Vegas entities that are going to be managing the casino, but I don't know that.
And there's no challenge that this is historic tribal territory?
We are not making that challenge in this lawsuit, no.
Okay.
The question is,
I've forgotten now, what is the gist of the complaint with respect to the validity of taking this land in trust?
Well, under the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Carcieri, the tribe had to be under federal jurisdiction in 1934.
Okay, got it.
Right, and the problem is that the tribe did have a relationship with the federal government. They were a signatory to a number of treaties, but then they basically broke that relationship. They put themselves under the jurisdiction of an Episcopalian
bishop.
That's
your merits argument, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But getting back to the standing question, you know, the teaching in Carcieri.
The prudential standing assumes that the plaintiff, the litigant, has injury in fact.
Correct.
Okay. What is it that your client has in addition to injury in fact that satisfies prudential standing?
Well, in order to satisfy it, he has to be someone who's in a position to police an interest that's arguably protected by the statute. And again, as the Supreme Court made clear in Carcieri, the interest here is to limit the tribes eligible for trust acquisition to those under federal jurisdiction in 1934. And as the Secretary's own regulations make clear, one of the interests protected by that language is the protection against incompatible land uses. And that is exactly the gravamen of the complaint here. An incompatible land use.
What do you mean incompatible land use?
That it's incompatible to take
what?
To take a Disney World like enterprise, a casino with 3 million visitors a year, and put it in the middle of a rural town of only 3,000 residents. And so it's true that Patrick.
Let's back up. I mean, under the IRA, the Secretary is given authority to take land and put it in trust for the benefit of Indians, right?
Correct.
And is that what you're challenging? That wasn't done here?
No, not at all.
You're just challenging that it wasn't done for Indians as recognized under the statute, right?
An Indian tribe that was under federal jurisdiction in 1934. Mm-hmm. All we're trying to do is enforce the statutory language as the Supreme Court just interpreted it in Carcieri.
And why do you get to enforce that?
Because our interest, like those in the National Credit Union, align with the interests of the statute. And maybe I should back up and spend 60 seconds on National Credit Union. You recall in that case, the question was whether financial institutions had prudential standing to challenge the National Credit Union Administration's approval of certain credit union applications. So there, it was a statute that regulated credit unions. Financial institutions were neither regulated nor beneficiaries. And yet the court said they had a prudential interest in enforcing the statute because their interests were aligned. They had an interest in limiting the jurisdiction of credit unions, and that was precisely one of the interests under the statute, at least arguably. Likewise here, Mr. Patchick has an interest to protect the land use in his community, to limit a tribe's eligibility to have a land taken in trust in this community.
Wouldn't your case be closer if your client wanted to open his own casino? I mean, the plaintiffs in the credit union were competitors, and your client is really antithetical to what the Indian tribe wants to do. I mean, he's not a competitor. He doesn't want to open his own casino.
Well, he's a land use competitor, Your Honor. He may not be trying to open up another casino, but financial institutions weren't trying to open credit unions either. But they had a conflicting use, and that's what's being alleged here. He wants his community.
Who isn't a land use competitor?
Yeah.
Why is he particularly aggrieved by this.
Well, it'd be limited to the members of his community. If they were putting a 3 million visitor casino in the heart of Chicago, then this really wouldn't be an issue. But the fact is, any one of those 3,000 residents should have an opportunity to address the secretary's abuse. You know, abuse isn't the right word.
So
going
anyone,
beyond the scope of his authority.
Anyone in the town has standing? Anyone in the town who doesn't want a casino to be there has standing?
I think anyone in the town who is protecting the interest that the statute seeks to protect.
How about anyone in the county? How far out do you go?
I think it would be difficult to make that argument.
Why?
Because the farther away you get, the less interested that person is. And at some point, it kind of blends into the injury in fact, the Lujan test, because at a certain point, there's no direct injury caused by someone who's in a neighboring county or the neighboring state, the neighboring country. You get farther away and you lose that. But here you've got someone who's right in town. He's going to be affected by the people, the traffic, and everything else. And what he's...
I just keep coming back to that's what the IGRA is for. I mean, I hear you say they're not adjacent, therefore they might not have standing, the people out in the county and in other
right.
than another county. And that's... I keep hearing, well, that's the... I mean, the statute you're supposed to bring it under is IGRA.
Right, but the fact that there could be an IGRA claim does not mean there is not an IRA claim. And the fact is, we've still got this statutory language, and I would like to spend 30 seconds on
the IRA. Can you point us to any cases where a court has held prudential standing under IRA under the facts similar to yours?
We cited two in our brief. And I would note that the tribe and the government have cited none where someone was held not to have prudential standing under the IRA. Unfortunately, the two cases that we cite don't have even as deep analysis as we've been talking about this morning.
What about Butte County?
Excuse me?
What about Butte County?
That was the first case, Your Honor. Butte County versus Hogan, a District of District Columbia case from 2009. And then the second is Tomac versus Norton. And in both of those cases, albeit without in-depth analysis, there was a challenge to the plaintiffs lacking prudential standing under IRA. And in both cases, in Tomac, involving a citizens group, very much like Mr. Patchick, the court, including this court in Tomac, affirmed that there was prudential standing. It's not a difficult test.
Well, in Butte County, the standing question was, as I recall, was litigated in the district court and then dropped when the case came up to us.
That's correct. Whereas in Tomac, it was litigated in the district court. The plaintiffs prevailed, and this court affirmed and said it's not even a difficult question to say that there's prudential standing not only under IGRA but also under IRA. It was both.
Well, it was standing raised. I thought.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Is it your ultimate contention that the secretary was not permitted to take this land in trust, or is the remedy you're seeking? You can keep it in trust, but you just can't build a casino?
No, it's that the secretary could not take it in trust, because under carcieri, the ban had to be under federal jurisdiction.
And
at minimum, that means...
handle the Quiet Title Act problem, then.
Okay, then let's back up
right
to that. We filed our claim under the APA. That waives governmental immunity. So the only way the Quiet Title Act comes into play is if somehow it overlaps, such that that is really the gravamen of our complaint. But Patrick doesn't have a Quiet Title Act claim. If you look at 28 U.S.C. 2409 small a sub d, that's the Quiet Title Act provision that says what are the requirements for a claim. This is on page small Roman numeral
let's
14.
Let's start with A, though. What does A say, 2409 A? What does that say?
I don't have A in front of me. But what D says is that a quiet title plaintiff must set forth
here's
the
particularity. What A says. The United States may be named as a party defendant in a civil action under this section to adjudicate a disputed title to real property, and then it accepts property that's trust or restricted Indian land. So, as I read it, sovereign immunity has not been waived for claims that adjudicate disputed title to real property that are Indian lands.
You have to keep going to see what the nature of the claim is. And under sub D, it says the plaintiff has to state the nature of the right, title, or interest which he claims in the real property. And that's not what we have here. And this case is on all fours with the D.C. District Court.
But you agree, though, that your claim is adjudicating title to property, right?
No, I do not agree with that.
Well, I mean, your prayer for relief asks that it be that the United States no longer be able to hold it in trust. Right?
Yes, but not because we're adjudicating title to property, because we're adjudicating whether this tribe was eligible for a land and trust acquisition under the IRA. And as the district
you
court...
You dispute that the United States has title in the property.
No, I do not dispute that. I mean, at this present time with the land and trust,
I mean,
yes.
You dispute that it should have right? If you prevail, the United States will not
correct.
Be able
to it would
come
out of trust. Correct.
That's title, right? The United States will no longer
have
title.
Yes, it is. But the Quiet Title Act is aimed at someone who has an interest in it.
You're getting to D. I just want to start with A. But,
yes.
But so far, you're under A. The only way you prevail is if you can convince us that D gets you out of it, right?
Right. And that's exactly what the District of Columbia District Court did in the City of Sault Ste. Marie case. And it walked through the statutory language, and it walked through the legislative history, and it said that a case just like this one, a land and trust acquisition, does not fall within the ambit of the Quiet Title Act.
That's subsection B, which you don't mention, I don't recall you. I mean, you put your all your marbles on D, right?
Yes.
But B itself says that that if the United States loses, the United States has the option of paying just compensation and keeping the land, paying just compensation to the plaintiff, which doesn't fit this litigation at all.
Completely agree with that, Your Honor, and just another reason why the Quiet Title Act does not fit this action. I see I have 10 seconds.
Are the documents concerning the acquisition of the land by the tribe in the record?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Do you know whether the land was conveyed to the tribe, or the tribe purchased the land, or it was conveyed to the secretary on condition that permission be granted to erect the casino?
I'm not sure what that underlying fact is, no.
All right, we'll give you a couple.
Okay, thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay. Mr. Avila?
May it please the Court, Aaron Avila on behalf of the federal appellees. With me at counsel's table is Ed Dumont, counsel for the tribe. I'll be using 10 minutes. I'd like to talk about the two threshold problems with Mr. Patchak's lawsuit. He lacks prudential standing, as the district court correctly ruled, and the Quiet Title Act preserves the United States' immunity from suit to Mr. Patchak's claim, which at bottom is a challenge to the United States' title to real property. As to the first issue, this court in Tomac specifically said that the plaintiffs there had Article III and prudential standing to challenge BIA's actions under both NEPA and IGRA. It didn't involve an Indian Regulatory Act claim. So I think that just disposes of that case. And Butte County was a district court decision, and also it was a county, not a private individual.
What do you do with your opponent's argument that we should be looking to the policing function to determine whether there's prudential standing?
Well, I think that has to be read, again, in light of the statutory purposes and provisions. And I think here, this argument is essentially that anyone who challenges agency action as being inconsistent with
not anyone. He's saying adjacent landowners who are going to be affected by this.
But the adjacent landowner, there's no basis in the statute for that to think that person is better positioned to police the statutory provision.
We recognize there are limitations on the secretary's ability to acquire land, right?
There are conditions that have to be met.
It's just analogous if instead of a casino, somebody had gotten permission from the EPA to put up a pollution spewing industrial smokestack, then the people that are affected are the adjacent landowners, and they have standing, right?
Well, they would have Article III standing, and then it would turn on the statutory provision pursuant to which the challenge is brought. Here, we don't have an Indian Gaming Regulatory Act challenge, which is the mechanism by which Congress set up the authorization of gaming facilities. And it's not the Indian Reorganization Act. And there's nothing in those statutory provisions which are dealing with tribal self-government, restoring tribal land bases that deals with the harms, the economic and environmental harms to non-Indians that this plaintiff invokes for prudential standing. So I think to be policing the statute, you have to invoke some provision of that statute that is relevant to you, and he fails to do that here.
The council said conflicting land use. What do you say to that?
Well, the statute itself isn't concerned with conflicting land uses, and it seems like anyone could allege conflicting land uses. And in fact, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, again, is the provision pursuant to which gaming can occur. It's not the Indian Reorganization Act.
Is that exclusive, though? Does IGRA preempt a cause of action under the IRA here?
Well, I don't know if I'd use preempt, but to the extent someone's concerned about harms from a gaming facility, the proper avenue, I mean, we litigated that case.
The proper avenue, is it the only avenue?
Well, I think for purposes of the zone of interest test, yes, because that's not what the Indian Reorganization Act is concerned with. I mean, and this court noted in the Hazardous Waste Treatment Council that a rule that gave a plaintiff standing merely because it happened to be disadvantaged by a particular agency decision would destroy the requirement of prudential standing.
How do you account for the regulations that they have to put a notice in the newspaper, and the purpose of that is to allow interested members of the public to seek judicial review of the secretary's decision? I mean,
And that was the Michigan gaming opposition case that we fully litigated it all the way through this court. And that was a NEPA, a National Environmental Policy Act, and an Indian gaming
regulation. Aren't the regulations Judge Randolph was referring to, aren't those under the IRA?
Yes.
IGRA?
Yes.
So answer that. Why, if there is no policing function like your opponent is arguing, why that those sorts of notice provisions and the opportunity to challenge in court?
Because the policing notion turns on the statute that you're trying to enforce, and in those cases, they were trying to enforce the National Environmental Policy Act and the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, not the Indian Reorganization Act.
I'm not talking about the cases. I'm talking about the regulations. Yeah.
And the regulations gave 30 days for people who met standing and prudential requirements
to challenge the IRA.
Right.
But raising challenges that other statutes weren't complied with.
The regulations don't say that.
But the regulations don't.
As I recall, the regulations simply say to give interested members of the public an opportunity to seek judicial review challenging the secretary's decision.
But it doesn't purport to.
It doesn't say on what ground.
But no, and the court's bedrock prudential standing requirements remain in place, and there's no indication.
I thought the regs actually refer to land use. That one of the things that they're allowed to challenge is land use.
That is one of the factors that the secretary considers when deciding to take land into trust pursuant to the regulations. There's nothing in the statute that mandates.
You raise an interesting question that I hadn't thought about. The Supreme Court cases, and I don't know about this court, but say the prudential standing doctrine is a judge-made doctrine. If Congress wants to do away with it, they can do away with it, right?
Correct.
Okay. Does that same kind of rule apply to regulations?
I don't think.
Can a regulation do away with a judge-made doctrine of prudential standing? And if it can, then why don't we just construe, what's the argument for not construing this regulation as having exactly that effect?
A couple of things. First of all, this is brought, the APA requires that a plaintiff be aggrieved within the meaning of a relevant statute. So I don't think by regulation, and I can't remember the case name we cited in our brief, where this court has held that regulations, guidance can't provide standing. So I think, whatever the merit to that argument.
What if the regulation has the effect of acknowledging that interested members of the community are aggrieved?
I don't think that's what that provision does, Your Honor. It recognizes that that's something the secretary will take into account when exercising his discretion to take land into trust. And that's not the provision that's trying to be enforced here. So I don't think that satisfies the prudential standing requirements. If I could briefly talk about the Quiet Title Act, the United States is immune from suits that challenge its title to trust or restricted Indian lands, and I think this lawsuit squarely falls within subsection A. Numerous courts have held, including the Supreme Court in Block, that you cannot use the Administrative Procedure Act.
What do you do about D, though? D is part of the statute, and it clearly anticipates that the claimant, that the petitioner, has some claim for a property interest in the land. And this complainant doesn't have that.
But I think the teaching of Block is that where Congress sets up a detailed judicial review provision, that is the exclusive mechanism.
But a detailed provision that doesn't apply here.
But much like if the statute of limitations had run, a plaintiff would say, well, I should be able to do this through the APA because I don't meet the conditions in the Act.
The question is whether the Quiet Title Act anticipates this sort of dispute. And the Quiet Title Act requires that the claimant have some claim to some property interest here, and this claimant doesn't even.
I think, as the Tenth Circuit has recognized in the neighbors for rational development case, it would be a very strange provision for Congress to give.
Congress does strange things.
It's difficult to believe that Congress intended for adverse claimants to have to go through this set procedure.
Let's not talk about what Congress intended. Let's talk about what Congress said. Well, how do you get around subsection D? It's there in the statute.
Because if under the Administrative Procedure Act, if relief is expressly or impliedly forbidden by another waiver of sovereign immunity, here there is an explicit waiver of sovereign immunity, a limited waiver of sovereign immunity in the QTA that expressly or impliedly forbids relief to non-adverse claimants. So I think that's, at the very least, how you deal with that. That
so you read D out of the statute, in other words.
No, what you read is that...
Does D apply to this claimant?
He has no adverse claimant, I think, which underscores that he can't challenge the United States title at all. I mean...
So if we're to read the Quiet Title Act to require that it only applies to claimants who fall under D, then... You lose this argument.
No, Your Honor, because in Block, the Supreme Court said that is the exclusive mechanism for challenging the United States title, whether you fall within it or not. Before the Quiet Title Act, no one could bring a lawsuit against the United States challenging its title. And now, with the Quiet Title Act, a limited exception has been applied, and it is inapplicable here. So the baseline is that the United States cannot be sued at all.
You know, in Motaz, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it right, in Motaz, when the court is explaining the history of the Quiet Title Act, they use the language, it excludes suits against the United States seeking title to lands held by the United States. This plaintiff is not seeking title to land.
But he's definitely trying to upset the United States.
There's no question about that. He's challenging the title. But the question is, for me, what do I do about subsection D? Because subsection D seems to require a plaintiff who's seeking title to lands, and this plaintiff is not.
But again, I think when Congress sets up that mechanism, the Administrative Procedure Act is not available where relief that is sought is impliedly forbidden.
Why can't you read it that when Congress sets up the mechanism for someone who claims a title in land, isn't that a better reading of the statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the baseline is that no one could bring a lawsuit against the United States challenging its title. Sovereign immunity would bar that completely. I see my time has expired. If the court has other questions.
All right.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Very briefly, the problem with Mr. Patchak's policing theory is simply this, that it collapses, it threatens to collapse the prudential standing inquiry into the injury in fact inquiry, because any plaintiff who has constitutional standing will have an injury in fact and will be able to come into the court and say, look, in this case, I have a concrete interest, I have an adversity to the defendant, and therefore I'm the appropriate party to police this line. That's not what's intended.
Consistent with the Supreme Court statement that this prudential standing is not very demanding.
It's not meant to be especially demanding, but it is a real limit. And this court has made clear that it is not supposed to collapse back into simply the constitutional standing inquiry. Now let me talk about the cases that culminate in NCUA, which are cases between banks and credit unions or banks and other financial institutions, have a logic to them, because in those situations, what the court, I think, perceived was that Congress was drawing a line, in effect, in a statute that demarcated a sphere of competition for one side and a sphere for the other. And that's why competitor standing made sense in those cases. This is not a competitor division case. This is not a case where the IRA draws any line that demarcates Indian tribes that are subject to benefits from somebody else. If there were any somebody else that fit that paradigm, it would be states or counties, because those are the entities that have governmental jurisdiction that is arguably implicated when the secretary recognizes the sovereign status of a tribe. But there's nothing like that for Mr. Patchak here. And there were some questions about
citizen. So the citizens don't have standing, but their government does? Is that your theory?
The government, the state or local government that has jurisdiction over a particular piece of territory or over where a tribe is located may have an interest that is analogous to the competitive interests that were at issue in NCUA in those cases, because the sovereign status and the governmental status that's being recognized in a tribe is, you know, arguably that's a demarcation that separates the other governments from the tribal government.
The county or the state is losing jurisdiction over a particular land area. Is that the idea?
That's the idea. That's the idea.
That's
and I'm not saying that
if the individual has a farm that's going to be impacted by 4,600 cars a day, that's not good enough.
Well, that's probably a constitutional injury in fact, and it's certainly a prudential injury under NEPA or under IGRA. And the way that these cases normally work.
Go back to this county local. What is the interest, under your theory, what is the interest the statute protects in that situation?
The statute confers benefits on Indians and Indian tribes in order to try to remedy the depredations of many years of bad policy, right? So it's a conferral of federal benefits on a defined group of beneficiaries. That's all it is.
I'm trying to think what the analysis is that the county can satisfy prudential standing.
Right. Well,
what you're telling me.
And I don't mean to suggest that I think the county or the state necessarily can. I think they are the most likely candidates.
But what is your analysis under prudential standing to get to the proposition that the county has prudential standing?
Because the consequence of a recognition of a tribal status under the IRA is to constitute that group as a semi-sovereign entity, analogous to a local government or a state government, and a different kind
what
of dependent sovereign.
Sorry. Please don't.
I don't mean to be
when I'm trying to interrupt you. Okay. What is the interest under your theory that the statute is designed to protect that the county falls within?
Taxing would be one.
Well, I think it threatens some taxing and other jurisdictional
interests. So the statute is designed to protect the taxing authority of the state or
no,
county?
It's designed to protect tribes and tribal entities. And the
it must be. See, what I'm pushing you toward is it seems to me that implicit in your suggestion that a county might have prudential standing is the idea that the statute limits the situations in which the secretary can take land into trust and allow the tribe to put a casino up, and that limitation is something that benefits if the county believes it does, would benefit the county because it would preserve the county's taxing authority, as Judge Henderson says, or the jurisdiction or whatever. Is that the underlying theory?
The statute limits the group of people to whom or groups to whom it accords federal benefits. That's the holding of Carcieri, the now under federal jurisdiction language, and the fact that you have to be an Indians or an Indian tribe. Those are limitations on the intended extent of congressional benefits. The only question here is whether anyone has standing to challenge a secretarial decision made on that basis on the theory that they are advancing the interests implicit in the statute. We think the answer to that, frankly, is no. Nobody has standing on that basis, and the interests of all these parties are antithetical to the interests that are advanced by the statute.
Even state and local government, you're saying?
The tribe's position would be even state and local governments don't have standing under the prudential standing cases. The government takes a different view, and
so
I think the logic
the only way they challenge this is under IGRA. That's the sole way to
they challenge when the cases are brought, they are challenges to the secretary's action under the IRA and taking land into trust. The premise in the normal case is that action is illegal under the APA because of a violation of IGRA or NEPA that is implicated by the decision to take the discretionary part of the decision to take land into trust. This case is in a rather different posture because what Mr. Patrick is challenging is actually not any of those discretionary aspects of the decision, but the fundamental entitlement of this group to be treated as entitled to any benefits at all under the IRA. And as to that, you know, his interest, there's a complete disconnect between his interests and the interests that are intended to be advanced by the statute.
Can I ask you just a question? I brought up the taxing. When these casinos are built, can the state or the local government, number one, first police it? I mean, or is it like a reservation? That is, do the casino, does the tribe police the casino, or can the local police or county police go in? Do you know that?
The basic answer is it becomes tribal territory, which has a separate sovereign status, and the tribe has jurisdiction there. Very often what happens in practice is that there are intergovernmental agreements entered into between the tribe as the sovereign of that territory and the local government with provisions for compensation to the government for the services it provides.
Okay, and how about taxing?
Taxing authority, local and state taxing authority is cut off when it becomes Indian territory. Again, in the gaming cases, quite typically there are financial arrangements that are worked out between the governments, the local governments involved.
Doesn't that depend on who operates the casino? For example, I think of the Cotton Petroleum case. Do you know that case?
I did at one time.
Yeah, it's the who pay. Can a state tax a oil company that's drilling on a federal Indian reservation? Severance taxes. The Supreme Court said yes, it can.
Well, it could tax. As I remember that, it was because it.
So if an independent contractor were running the casino, why couldn't the state tax the independent contractor?
IGRA has quite carefully articulated requirements that require the gaming operation to be run directly by the tribal government. There sometimes are management contracts involved, but they have to be approved by the NIGC. They're very closely monitored.
Okay.
Can I ask a question? Yeah, could you answer the QTA question about the subsection D?
Here's my answer to the QTA question. I think you have to roll the camera back a little bit. Mr. Patchett claims jurisdiction under the APA's jurisdictional waiver, the waiver of sovereign immunity. That waiver is qualified by language that says if any other statute granting jurisdiction expressly or impliedly limits jurisdiction, then the APA is not intended to override that. I think when you go and look at Block and Motaz, the reason that Block and Motaz have formed the basis for all the circuit cases that have gone the government's way on this issue, which is all of them, is that what Block says is, look, there was a lot of confusion in the law. There were these officer suits, which were a way of getting at territory claims. There were other things going on. But Congress decided in 1972, or whenever it passed the QTA, to regulate this area, to bring rationality and order to this area. And it decided to pass a comprehensive scheme, which is the QTA. And that defines the terms under which you can do anything that, in effect, challenges the government's title to land.
Block and Motaz, didn't they involve adversarial claims? Plaintiffs who claimed an interest in the title?
Block did involve the state that claimed mineral rights, I think, and Motaz was very complicated. Motaz was somebody who said she was claiming under the General Allotment Act. It was never clear whether she wanted the territory back or just monetary compensation. It's complicated, but there was a claim under.
But both of them were folks who claimed some property interest in the disputed land.
Yes, that's right.
Which we don't have here, so that's why I'm confused.
That. I think these cases are harder, but I think what you take away from Block is in particular the officer suit discussion, which is there was a whole scope of suits that had to do with saying, well, look, I can't challenge the government's title, the federal government's title, therefore I will sue the officer.
I understand it's a comprehensive scheme, but if you've got the language of subsection D that sure makes it sound like it's a comprehensive scheme for when someone who claims an interest in the property is challenging title.
And we don't claim that Mr. Patchett has a claim or would ever have a claim under the QTA, even absent the Indian lands exception. What we say is the fact that Congress, when it looked at the sphere of challenges to federal title over land, chose to accept Indian land claims, is an implied statement by Congress that there are not to be other challenges, including challenges in the nature of an ultra-virus officer suit, which is what Block goes to, and which is what the APA really is, right? The APA is officer suits. It's challenges to official action by government officers. And what Block tells us is the QTA was meant to cover the waterfront here, and there's an exception in the QTA for Indian land cases.
I want to ask you one minor question. I don't know that we'd even get to it, but and you don't want us to, but you said in your brief that that under federal jurisdiction in the statute is not the equivalent of federal recognition of the tribals.
Correct.
Right. That is contrary to the position of the United States, isn't it?
It is contrary to a position that was expressed in argument in the Cartieri case. That's about what historically had been true. I don't know, and I wouldn't presume to speak.
I'm just relying on what was it, Justice Souter's opinion said that the Solicitor General took the position that federal recognition is the equivalent of under federal jurisdiction.
With respect, I think the only way I would qualify that is to say that he said that, or the counsel had said that had traditionally been the view in recent years under the government's understanding of the statute as they then understood it, which, of course, did not include the statutory construction that was adopted in Cartieri. So I have no idea what the federal government's view of that issue is.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how the Secretary of the Interior, if they conducted any internal review, could possibly, if the plaintiff is correct, could possibly have taken this land into trust if that is the position of the United States, because I don't see any evidence that there was federal recognition of your client.
Well, we respectfully, recognition in the modern legal sense, we agree with that. There was not official recognition in 1934. But I would also say that it's very clear, and Justice Thomas's majority opinion for the court twice invokes the canon that all words and phrases in a statute must be given meaning. So I don't see how you take, with all respect to whatever the United States position may have been, I don't see how you take under a recognized Indian tribe, now under federal jurisdiction, and give the same meaning to recognition and federal jurisdiction. They're simply different concepts.
Can I ask counsel for the federal government, has your position changed since the argument in Cartieri?
You know, the department's currently addressing the Cartieri decision and the court accurately represented what counsel said at that argument, but that was obviously before the court's decision in Cartieri, and given that decision, the department's reevaluating that. And that's why we believe if you get to the merits of this case, it should be remanded to the district court.
Can I ask you a question that is totally outside the record, and I could be wrong, but these casinos, I thought, one reason they were attracted to states was they were also revenue producing for the states or for the counties. If that's true, is that because of agreements between tribes and, say, the county or the state, or am I wrong about their being attractive? In other words, the landowners represented by the plaintiff don't want it, but does the local government want it because they're going to work out an agreement whereby they get some revenue too?
The local governments and the state governments do want this casino. There's a compact with the state of Michigan. To answer your question, yes, it's typically advantageous to the governments that it is always done by agreement. There's always has to be a compact with the state for Class 3 gaming under IGRA. There very typically are agreements with the localities for, as I said, both for reimbursement for services that are provided and other kinds of revenue sharing. And among other things, you know, this casino is going to bring several hundred permanent jobs to a county with 14% unemployment. So there are many reasons why the local governments and the state government in this case are, to our knowledge, four square on the side of the government.
Thank you. Mr. Burke, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Judges Randolph and Griffith, I think you're right to focus on the regulations as the key to unraveling the standing problem. And actually, Judge Henderson, to go back to your question about whether there's a case, I want to correct a misstatement by the Secretary with respect to what the Tomac case decided that this court affirmed. In Tomac, the district court recognized that Tomac had to demonstrate their interests fell within the zone of interest regulated by the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, IGRA, and the the department's land and trust regulations, which is what I've been talking about this morning. And that's at 190 of the Tomek opinion, 193 F sub second at 190. The district court acknowledged that the regulations provided for consideration of land use conflicts, exactly what we've been talking about this morning, and that the Tomek members, like Mr. Patchak, were precisely the type of plaintiffs who could be expected to police those interests. So that's why the Tomek court found that there was prudential standing, and this court summarily affirmed that standing holding, concluding that there was really no close question on that. So the key is the regulations. There is a limit on the statute. One of the interests specified in the regulation is conflicting land use. Patchak is an appropriate person to police that interest. With respect to quiet title, I think the focus on subsection D is the appropriate one. Courts that have gone the other way using the loose language in Block have not recognized that Block was a case where an interest in the title to the land itself was asserted. Here we've got that, and so you've got to look to see what the parameters of the claim are. Subsection D is the way to do that. I would note that even if you conclude that the court got it wrong in Sault Ste. Marie, there's still this issue of whether the title, Quiet Title Act issue should be looked at as of the time of filing. And that's discussed at length in our Rule 28J letter. There's the recent Iowa Tribe decision, and there's a 5-3 circuit split on that right now. We're on the majority side of that. Lastly, and very briefly, on the merits of the carcieri issue. First, yes, Judge Randolph, the best way to interpret under federal jurisdiction is the way the government articulated it in carcieri, which means recognized. There's no dispute the tribe here was not recognized in 34. In addition, if you just think about this practically, what it means to be under federal jurisdiction, I don't deal with a lot of tribes, and I don't deal with jurisdictional issues like that. So the common sense analogy to me was Puerto Rico. You know, it's not a U.S. state, but it's under U.S. jurisdiction. Now imagine that, like the Gun Lake Tribe, Puerto Rico said, we're not going to honor any of our commitments to the U.S., we're not going to accept any more funding, and we're going to declare ourselves to be under the jurisdiction of the Vatican. And the Vatican said, yes, we'll take jurisdiction over you, and the federal government then administratively terminated Puerto Rico as the United States territory. There's no question in that instance that Puerto Rico would no longer be under federal jurisdiction and entitled to benefits
Your
under any U.S. statute.
Didn't participate in any way before the Department of the Interior, right?
What do you mean? In the process, he did submit comments in response to their filing of the notice of intent to take the land in trust, yes.
That was afterwards, right? That was while the case was in court?
No. As you were mentioning before, with the regs that require them to file a notice of intent 30 days before they take the land in trust, that's an opportunity for the public to give their comments. Mr. Patchak was one of the people who submitted comments about this project.
Was that before the other litigation began?
Yes, it was.
It was before?
Okay. Yes.
And what was his comment?
That he objected to this because it was an incompatible land use, among other things.
Okay.
Unless you have any further questions. Thank you very much for your time this morning.